Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I was lonely then, like an alien. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Polkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And yes, folks, we're going to talk about aliens again today.
Yes.
Because there's nothing more futuristic than where life on Earth came from. Wait a second.
Well, sometimes to go forward, you first must move backward.
What did the two topics I just said have to do with each other?
Well, in this case, we're talking about kind of a model that's been made that could possibly predict where we would most likely find aliens. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, yeah, because alien life had to come from somewhere. Our life had to come from somewhere. Studying one can potentially lead to figuring stuff out about the other.
Right, and it's possible that both the alien life and our life came from the same place.
Wait a minute, I saw Prometheus.
Yeah.
Did not think about the Prometheus tie-in when I agreed to do this topic.
Joe has feelings about Prometheus.
Oh. Don't we all have feelings about Prometheus?
I don't. I never watched it.
Oh, okay. It makes me feel things about Wile E. Coyote, mostly.
Yeah, okay. There is a bald, godlike, muscled figure in it that I suppose you might be able to relate to somewhat, Jonathan.
Yeah. Being the bald, muscular dude that I am, I'm mostly made of fluffernutter, actually.
I was emphasizing the godlike part.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I'll take it.
This is a thing that happens in the movie Prometheus. You see these bald, pale weirdos flying throughout the galaxy, seeding life on other planets. So he sets down on what looks like some part of Iceland and appears to plop some weird DNA goop into the water, and boom, life on Earth.
Yeah, and we're going to get to a theory that is essentially, or really I should say a hypothesis, that is essentially that.
So, a little bit less purposeful, I would say.
Depending
versions
on
of
how,
it. Yeah.
Sure.
So
maybe.
to kind of just do a quick run through of some of the stuff we mentioned before with alien life, just so that we, have a foundation here. One of the things we have often referenced on this show is the Drake equation, which is a probabilistic formula created by Dr. Frank Drake.
Sure. And this equation is an equation, but when you think of an equation, you often think of something that has lots of known values in it,
right,
that you can manipulate to your will.
Potentially.
Yeah. This is more of a thought experiment expressed in the form of a mathematical equation with lots of variables.
Yeah, it's meant to be a way to kind of estimate how many technologically advanced alien civilizations would be out there. But in order to actually get a number on that, we would have to have a lot more information than what what we currently have.
Yeah, but you arrive at it by multiplying a bunch of different probabilities. And of course, as you know, when multiplying probabilities, if any of these probabilities are in fact zero, then your product in the end is going to be zero.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if they're fractions, your product in the end is going to be tiny.
Yeah, it's going to get smaller and smaller as you multiply these small fractions together.
Yeah. So here are some of the things, here are all the things that go into the Drake equation. First, you take the rate of formation of stars capable of developing and supporting intelligent life. That's your first number, which already is a little complicated because we're basing this on a sample size of one,
mm-hmm,
right? Because based upon our assumptions, we could say, all right, let's just look at the stars that are sun-like. But it may be that there are other types of stars that also are able to support life. It's just life that's very different from the kind that we have on our planet.
Yeah, sure. What if there is life on planets orbiting red giants?
Right.
Life on planets orbiting neutron stars?
Right. There's also the possibility of life on rogue planets, which don't orbit a star at all.
Or on comets or...
Yeah, so
which I guess orbit stars, never mind.
But still, it's not a planet.
Rogue comets.
Sure, I guess. Well, I mean, whatever they're doing, whether or not they're orbiting a star, they're orbiting the galactic center out
there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then you take that number and you multiply that by the fraction of those stars that have planetary systems, because some stars do not.
I want to come back to this variable in a minute.
Yep. Then you multiply that by the number of planets per solar system that have an environment suitable for life.
Ditto for this.
Multiply that by the fraction of suitable plants on which life is present. Multiply that by the fraction of life-bearing planets on which intelligent life can evolve. And then multiply that by the length of time such civilizations release detectable signals into space.
You know, one of the funny parts about this thought experiment is that back when it was first articulated, I think more of these probability variables were just big question marks.
Sure.
No idea at all. But a couple of the things you mentioned are actually figures where we are starting to gain some relevant knowledge, where we could actually look at this and say, here's a good guess for what this number would be. For example, the fraction of stars that have planetary systems.
Oh, yeah. We're learning more about exoplanets every day.
Yeah. I mean, that's something we can actually put a pretty reasonable estimate on now. And back at the time, we didn't know.
Right. Yeah. Although, of course, there are other parts of that variable that we would have to add to, you know, we have some information about some of the planets about whether or not there are any kind of, you know, markers for potential biological life. But for the most part, we don't know for a lot of those exoplanets yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've certainly never received a signal that's like, hey, guys, text me back.
Right.
So.
Right.
Right.
Your tote's not in the group message. What's wrong with you guys?
But I do think it's interesting that here's one figure where we used to not know, and now we have a pretty good idea. And there are other ones where we're about to get a much better idea. Like we're about to be able to use telescopic techniques to learn more about the environments of exoplanets.
Sure.
So like whether they have an atmosphere that we think would be conducive to life. I mean, who knows what's really conducive to life, but at least in our
life
best
as we
estimation.
Know it.
Right. Yeah. Conducive to our type of life. Yeah. So this means that we are slowly filling in those blanks, but, we're still far away from being able to use this equation in any real meaningful way.
Now, of course, there's another way we could try and see if there are technological civilizations out there, which is listen and see if they're broadcasting anything.
Tune in to those text messages.
Yeah, in this case, we're talking largely about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which scans the sky for any radio transmissions and then goes through all the data that comes back, tries to find anything that's meaningful that looks like it's a purposeful broadcast as opposed to random noise. And that's, you know, a good approach too. We figure that that's more likely to result in us discovering life than just, say, direct observation or having some alien stumble upon us. Those two are not terribly likely.
Of course, as you probably know, SETI has not really turned up anything so far unless you want to count some possibly anomalous, weird signals like the WOW signal.
Yeah, most of the stuff that people think are probably, pulsar related or other naturally related phenomena. And space is huge. I don't know if you've read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Like really big.
Yeah, exactly. You thought it was a long way down to the chemists, but that's peanuts compared to space. Space is enormous. So focusing on any section of space is like, it's like you're in a massive arena. You have been blindfolded and spun around a huge number of times, and your goal is to throw a dart at a tiny target that's someplace around you, and maybe you'll hit it. Like, that's – and even that is being pretty optimistic compared to just pointing telescopes out to space to try and listen for stuff. But we might be able to narrow down that search a bit if we're able to make some predictions about where life would most likely arise.
And of course, this brings us to what we were alluding to at the beginning of the episode, which is the panspermia hypothesis.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I want to clear up at the beginning here, because I think I've encountered a lot of confusion about this, at least when I read people leaving comments about it online and stuff. A lot of people think that panspermia is a hypothesis about the origins of life, which it's not.
No, it's about distribution of life.
Yeah. So the origins of life is a big question in science and, you know, in physics and chemistry and organic chemistry. We don't know exactly how life comes about from the molecules that exist in the universe. And that's a big question that a lot of really smart people are working on, and it's a big interest of mine. But panspermia is the idea of not how life comes about, but how life got here.
Yeah, exactly. It's more about not just how life got here, but how could life potentially get to other places in the galaxy?
Exactly right.
So panspermia is a Greek word. It means seeds everywhere. And the hypothesis posits that seeds of life are scattered throughout the universe and can be propagated through space. And this is not that new of an idea. It might sound, you know.
Yeah, this was not like golden age of science fiction kind of idea.
Right.
It's been around for a minute.
Yeah, it's been around. Actually, if you want to go way back, the actual origins of the word panspermia date back to ancient times. But to really get into a point where it became part of the conversation in scientific circles, you need to look at the mid 18th century. Benoit de Malier wrote in 1743 that he thought that Earth was seeded by life, essentially kind of germs, falling from space into the oceans rather than through abiogenesis. And that kind of leads us to the question, what is abiogenesis?
Right. Well, that idea includes abiogenesis somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, life still has to begin somewhere, begin replicating, and then spread.
Well, abiogenesis could be part of that. For the scientifically minded, it certainly is part of that.
Oh,
whether that was
right.
what he thought, I don't
right,
know.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So also, yeah, I guess it's worth acknowledging some people would also attribute this to some kind of supernatural cause.
Sure.
That's not really the type of stuff that
we're
really qualified to talk about.
We're
here
looking
today.
At the scientific side.
Yeah.
Yes.
And abiogenesis is a theory that was really popular. I mean, like Aristotle talked about how completely obvious it was that it was true for a very long time. And it's the idea that life can be generated from non-living things.
Right.
For example, the idea that wasn't disproven until like the mid-1600s, I think, that maggots come from dead stuff.
Right. Like that, something dies and then maggots spontaneously.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Not that eggs get laid in dead stuff
right.
and then the maggots grow from them, but that they just spontaneously show up.
Yeah, some of these ideas are so funny. One of them was, I remember reading about this guy named Jean-Baptiste Van Helmont, who was the 17th century physician who said that if you got a sweaty shirt and you put it in a box of grain and then covered it up and left it, I think he said leave it for a few weeks or something and then come back, it will have sprouted mice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mice come from hay. Bees come from flowers.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's so good.
Like, how else could you explain mice in a box of grain that you left there for several weeks?
And while these ideas are obviously comical to us, the concept of abiogenesis itself is not necessarily that ridiculous in that it's really looking more at, could life have arisen from some combination of organic but non-living materials under certain conditions?
Yeah,
oh, sure, sure. That chemistry is responsible for life.
Yeah, the big difference is that spontaneous generation had to do with complex organisms spontaneously arising out of non-living material,
right.
whereas typically if you talk to a molecular biochemist who's working on the problem of abiogenesis today, they're trying to figure out how DNA was assembled out of, you know, chemical soups and conditions in, you know, the Earth like 3.8 billion years ago.
Yeah,
right.
And I have a thing to say about that way at the end of the episode. But
right.
for now,
let's get back to the panspermia hypothesis. So we've got this idea that there are some sort of seeds of life out there in the galaxy. How they came about is not addressed in this hypothesis, as Joe had mentioned earlier, but they might be carried by an asteroid or a comet or a meteorite or even exist as part of interstellar dust pushed around by the solar wind.
Microbe delivery.
Yep. Now, clearly, these would be what we would call extremophiles.
Right, because they'd have to survive the ride. And we've talked on this show so many times about how the ride through space is not a nice ride.
No. It's pretty harsh.
Yeah. You got the vacuum going. You got radiation going. You got extreme temperatures going. You got lots of different types of pressure changes going as these items move into the atmosphere of a planet.
Yeah, so obviously organisms like us are not going to be surviving this ride, but there are organisms we know of on planet Earth that survive bizarrely harsh conditions.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Yeah. There's various bacteria, I think, that can survive inside volcanoes. There's those water bears. Those are great.
Yeah, the water bears. I love them. Tardigrades.
They're so cute. I just want to pinch their little microscopic cheeks.
I can't wait till the horror movie where they get blown up to human size and then they just vacuum our liquids out.
I'm pretty sure that's sea monkeys.
Watch that today.
So, yeah, there are examples of extremophiles here on Earth that can live in conditions that we would find completely inhospitable, although to flip that, they would find the conditions we live in to be completely inhospitable. So there's some pretty interesting examples of that. And panspermia suggests that these organisms would arrive at a planet. In other words, there'd be a collision. You'd have an asteroid or a comet or a meteorite collide with a planet, and anything surviving on that could potentially spread to that planet. And there are three major variations of this hypothesis.
Right, because this obviously it asks some questions of us. We say, okay, so life is maybe frozen in a comet somewhere, headed toward Earth for millions of years. It finally smashes into Earth, starts spreading here. How'd it get on the comet?
Yeah, and panspermia doesn't answer those questions necessarily, although there are some variations of the hypothesis that at least suggest it. You don't get to the point zero origin, but you can get to, all right, well, in this way, something could be ejected from a planet and therefore make its way to some other place.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just asking one step back. So, like, did it come from another star in the galaxy?
Gotcha.
Or did it come from another planet in the solar system? Or did it come from somebody with some ideas?
Right. So with that first version, you've got lithopanspermia. That's interstellar panspermia. That suggests that a planet that supports life somewhere is in like a star system. There's some sort of major collision that happens and bits o planet break off and get ejected into space. And those bits o planet happen to have life forms on them. Obviously, it would have to be in some kind of bacterial format or something similar to that. It could not be, you know, Ed. Like, Ed would not
probably
make the trip.
Probably right. Not yeah. Unless he brought a really good spacesuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're imagining here kind of a at the end of the Neverending Story situation.
The little grain.
No. I'm imagining when it doesn't have a scene where like the planet's all smashed up into pieces and there are bits flying apart.
Yeah. And then, well, eventually there's only one little grain of sand left.
Okay.
And
yeah.
You have to make wishes to make it grow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I forgot that part.
And then you get a luck dragon. So, you get these massive collisions where stuff gets ejected into space. That stuff ends up finding its way to other solar systems. So this is a huge amount of distance these things would have to travel, right?
You'd have to be some hardy organisms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have to be probably in essentially suspended animation, the equivalent to that, for millions of years to make a trip from one solar system to another. But it is one of the three versions of panspermia we tend to talk about. Then there's ballistic panspermia. This is interplanetary panspermia. This would happen within the confines of a single solar system.
Right. So if you've ever heard the hypothesis that originally life on Earth came from Mars, that would be an example of this.
Right. So imagine that you have Mars and there's some sort of massive bombardment of Mars, which it results with tons of stuff being ejected from Mars and heading toward Earth, eventually colliding with Earth. That would be this version.
Mm-hmm.
So those are your two basic stuff just happens naturally. But then you've got the third kind.
Right, directed panspermia. And that is, in fact, the Prometheus model.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much. It definitely includes that the person spreading the life must be naked and huge and muscly. That's
bald.
Part of the hypothesis
yeah.
It's written in.
Yeah.
It's
science, guys.
Clearly
science.
In the small print because I did not see that when I was looking this over. directed panspermia is essentially the idea that some intelligent life form is purposefully spreading life by shooting out whatever bodies, you know, like rocks or whatever they may be, could even be rockets filled with bacteria to go to distant places. And potentially to propagate life that way.
Now, I'm wondering if this includes life that's spread by accident. Because, I mean, that would have to sort of be another option if it weren't part of directed panspermia. You know what I mean?
Sort of like if one of our probes a long time in the future ran into another planet and it has bacteria in it and that winds up spawning an entire civilization.
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it reminds me a little bit. This isn't the same thing, really, but it reminds me a little bit of when we were first getting some reports that that one of the rovers had detected the presence of methane on Mars, and people got excited. And then the scientists were saying, "Listen, we have to make sure that this wasn't a contamination; that it wasn't brought along."
Right.
And of course, it was.
Yes. And that's one of those things where, you know, we already have instances of the stuff we've sent to other bodies carrying things with it that were not necessarily intentional.
I want to go on a little digression real quick and say, if you read any headline anywhere on the internet saying that we have found life on Mars and you haven't already noticed people freaking out about this, it's probably not true.
Yeah.
They're probably just trying to con you into a click. I clicked on something to CNN's website the other day that was like, life on Mars. And I was like, how come I haven't heard about this?
Yeah.
And you know what it was? It was rocks. It was some rocks that looked like lizards and squirrels. And one of them just looked like a pyramid. And I'm like, there's no living pyramid. That just looks like a thing that you recognize.
There's Pyramid Head.
There is. He is a living pyramid.
He's a living thing, but if you run into him, you are not likely to be living for much longer.
Actually, he might be undead, technically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, have they found undead things on Mars?
What a wonderful end to the Curiosity rover is Pyramid Head just puts that one big blade through it, and you hear the scraping sound, and that's the last transmission.
If you don't know who Pyramid Head is, I suggest you Google search it.
Anyway, sorry, back to the matter at hand.
Yes.
Right. So specifically looking at Earth, is it possible that life here on the planet did not arise through abiogenesis here on Earth, but instead was the result of a seed of life landing on Earth? Well, one argument for this hypothesis, one of the things that people argue to support it, is that life on Earth appears to have developed sometime around 3.83 billion years ago.
That's interesting. I've never heard it dated with that much precision before. I've always heard like around 3.5 or 4 billion years.
Yeah, I'm guessing that this itself is an estimation. Well, obviously it's an estimation.
Right.
It's like no one was around there to start doing tick marks to
Well, no, I guess I'm just curious where that number comes from, because I've never heard one that precise
before. Yeah, it was in the source I was reading, they were specifically calling it out that specific, but I honestly find that a little convenient too. But at any rate, around that same time period, around between 3.8 and 4 billion years ago, Earth went through a period of bombardment where meteorites were hitting the planet fairly regularly. And so this timing seems to somewhat support that argument, the idea that perhaps some of these meteorites contained elements of life on them, whether they were the bacteria or the missing secret sauce that was going to allow life to happen here on Earth, and that as a result, that's why we have life here on Earth. However, there's nothing conclusive. Like, there's no smoking gun here. It could just as easily be that it's an abiogenesis approach here on Earth, and that this was something that also happened around that same time.
Well, I mean, another way you could look at the coincidence of the origins of life and the bombardment period is you could say that the bombardment created conditions or introduced materials that made the abiogenesis process happen.
Right. So in other words, it wasn't that there were life forms on the meteorites themselves. It was just that was one more ingredient into life.
Like, I feel like I've read – don't hold me to this because I could be mistaken, but I think I've read that some people hypothesize this is where a lot of Earth's water came from.
Mm-hmm.
Like during this bombardment period, there were a lot of icy objects that slammed into the Earth and brought water to the surface.
I've heard the same thing. And another argument in support of the Earth's life comes from Space Seeds, which I believe is a fantastic Star Trek episode that introduces Khan.
I know that
Space
one.
Seed is the Khan episode. Chekhov, by the way, not in that episode. So I don't know how Khan recognizes him in Wrath of Khan. But that's beside the point. Anyway.
Is it really beside the point?
It's really the point. I wanted to make this whole episode about that, but I was trying to kind of hide it by
all this. I imagine Chekhov does a lot of, like, Facebook snooping around Kirk and his friends.
But how would Khan know about Chekhov? Because he says, I never forget a face, Mr.
From Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. That's probably right.
I tell you, you got to unfriend Khan. That's rule number one. So another
make your Instagram feed's private.
Another argument in support of that hypothesis that Earth, in fact, was seeded by outer space bacteria is that that bacteria can be dormant for a really, really long time, and
yeah,
then
and that's true.
Yeah, and they can then be viable, right? It's not just that they stick around and then they could come back. So, for example, there have been cases where we have retrieved bacteria from sources that had been trapped for as many as 250 million years and the bacteria were still viable. Mm-hmm. So stuff like finding bacteria in the gut of bees that had been embedded in amber for millions of years and the bacteria once extracted regained viability. So there are examples of pretty
sleep.
Yeah. It's amazing that this can even happen.
That's creepy.
Yeah. It is a little creepy. Yeah. There are a couple.
I mean, that's great.
Yeah.
I guess for science, but cool.
Like these bacteria don't remember dinosaurs because there weren't dinosaurs yet.
They slept right through dinosaurs. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that this does mean that there is at least some feasibility for the panspermia hypothesis, because we've seen instances where bacteria can survive very long periods and then come back from being dormant. Whether or not significantly longer than 250 million years, I don't know. And even an interplanetary panspermia hypothesis suggests that it could be millions of years from the point when something is ejected into space to the point where it collides with another planet. Mm-hmm. That's just interplanetary. When you take in solar systems into account, star systems into account, that's an enormous, enormous amount of time.
Yeah. So I think panspermia is a really interesting hypothesis. It's one of those that for a long time, at least, I think it's probably just going to remain an interesting hypothesis because we don't have strong enough ways of confirming or disconfirming it. You can only just sort of look for evidence that's consistent or inconsistent with it.
Sure, but that doesn't mean that people are not running mathematics on it.
Right. In fact, we've got some astrophysicists out of Harvard who wanted to try and start building a predictive model based upon the panspermia hypothesis. So they're not testing the hypothesis. Right. That's not what their research is all about. Their research starts from the premise that assuming this hypothesis is true, then we should be able to start predicting where life would where the point of origin would be from any given explosion of life that moves outward. Mm-hmm. And then we would have a better idea of where to look if we're searching for evidence of that life. So basically they are creating a model that – think of it like a Google Maps type thing of the Milky Way galaxy, except instead of showing you where the traffic is, it's showing you circles of where life would likely be found due to some evidence that there was this panspermia permutation, this spreading of life.
Okay.
Hmm.
So based on this, they suggest, well – life would probably spread out in kind of a full expanding globe around whatever body was impacted.
Sure.
Yeah. So you just say, all right, well, the planet that originated the life, wherever that life may be, go an equal distance out in every direction, and that's where the seeds of life would be spread. And so it was that to me is already an interesting idea. So they're suggesting that it's not something that would be purely directional, where there'd be an impact and straight on the other side would be where the life goes out and that's it. They're saying, no, think of it like almost like an explosion. In fact, they likened it to the way an epidemic spreads and talked about how the galaxy could be infected with life, which
well,
goes
as
like
we all
Agent
know,
Smith.
Yeah, I was about to say human beings are a disease.
They're a disease,
so
a cancer. So if we work from this hypothesis and we assume that the Earth is, let's say, on the edge of one of these bubbles, we don't necessarily think that because we have no evidence yet to think one way or the other. But let's assume that we are.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Then
we'll play along.
Yeah. Then what would need to happen next is we would actually still need to look somewhere and find some evidence of, if not life, not direct evidence of life, at least some biomarkers that could indicate the presence of life. And according to this model, the best thing to do at that point would be to really focus your attention in that general direction and kind of ignore everything on the other side. Because if Earth is on the edge of one of these bubbles, everything behind us would be lifeless. Everything ahead of us in from that perspective would be potentially
lifeful.
Yeah, full of life. Now, that, of course, assumes that we're on the edge of a bubble and not in the middle. If we're in the middle, then technically everywhere we look should still have lots of potential for life. But it is an interesting idea. It does obviously have some drawbacks. For example, we still have to find evidence of some form of life somewhere in order for us to even have an idea of where to look. But from that point, we could start to model where the life would most likely be found. And then we could concentrate our efforts in those directions, thinking that perhaps it's possible that we could discover intelligent life that way, because we'd have a specific direction to focus on. The other thing to keep in mind is that over the course of millions of years, star systems move in relation to one another. Mm-hmm. And if this event happened many, many, many hundreds of millions of years ago, then it makes it more difficult to figure out where that central spot would be, because the star systems have continued to move apart or, in relation to one another over that time.
Yeah. I mean, you can think about it the way that, that the Earth is not always a constant distance from Venus or Mars. Likewise, the solar system is not always a constant distance from other solar systems.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything in space is moving around.
Yeah. I imagine it as, let's say that you've got a bowl of water and you have like a little drop of food coloring that can float on the surface of that water, and you drop it. And at first it's a nice little circle that starts to spread, but eventually it starts to break up and move around in relation so that things that used to be right next to each other now might be across the bowl of water from one another.
Mm-hmm. So we need to create a model for the way that the universe and our little localized region of it has been spreading, like
yes.
A very detailed model in order to really get to the bottom of this.
And to understand that, we would need to at least have an estimation of how long ago the life spread out in the first place. Now, here on Earth, we're talking possibly, around 4 billion years ago or so.
But
that's a lot of time.
But how long did it take to get here?
Yeah, exactly. So, it gets harder and harder.
4 billion plus X?
Exactly. Yeah. So, in other words, this is a really interesting thought experiment, and I'm sure that it will end up being useful in the long run. It's just one of those where I still think that there are some variables that we can't fill in yet. Even even if we were to discover a distant planet that appears to have these markers for biological activity, it would be very difficult for us to estimate when that would have happened.
Yeah.
In the galactic time scale.
Yeah. It would be really nice if our giant, bald, alien neighbors would just send us a message and be like, hey, we did this about this long ago in Earth years.
In which case we're like, well, the whole reason we were looking into it was to talk to you, so I guess now we can just stop anyway. Plus, you could just tell us where you put it.
We have a lot of questions, it turns out.
First of all, have you shopped at a store? Like, there's a lot of clothing stores that we can hook you up with here on Earth.
You know, if you feel like it,
yeah.
That's, no shame. No shaming.
I'm just imagining a really interesting moment in the future of humanity when, let's say, we do encounter microbial life somewhere out there, whether it's on Mars or it's on a comet or something like that, and we bring it back and we say, okay, it's time to let's assume it's DNA based.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The moment when we test that to see, do we share genes with this thing? Because it seems like that would be the test. I mean, I'm not an astrobiologist. I don't really know. But my guess would be the test for panspermia, the real test would be you find an alien life form, and then you test it the same way we look for ancestral similarity in life forms on Earth. You say, okay, do you match these points of loci on a you know, gene panel? And if you do, wow, I mean, that's interesting. I'd imagine you could also probably be able to look at its genome and our genome and determine, based on assumptions about the mutation rate, about how long ago we split apart, right?
I suppose. I mean, it's...
Roughly, those kind of estimates are pretty shaky on a you know, global time scale, but absolutely.
Yeah, we could at least look to see if there are enough common elements to make an educated guess at it. We're talking so much in the hypothetical here.
Yeah, I'm out of my depth here, yeah. But that's very interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, that super interesting idea for this work. But again, it really depends on this panspermia hypothesis being the way that life travels or distributes throughout the galaxy and the universe.
Yeah, and I wanted to go back to the concept of abiogenesis for a minute and talk about one of the alternate theories about how bodies impacting Earth could have led to life on Earth coming about.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you mean without just bringing it here?
Without just bringing it, without like bringing a water bug and, you know, our common ancestor, the water bug, propagating all life on Earth.
All right, let's hear it.
Water bear, what am I even talking about? Well, I'll stick with water bug actually at this point. So research from multiple teams has found building blocks of life as we know it, amino acids, in comets. And in one experiment at the University of Hawaii in Manoa, chemists simulated a comet-like environment, like 10 degrees Kelvin above zero, and in this ball of ice that included carbon dioxide and ammonia and methane and ethane and propane and stuff like that. And when they zapped this ball with simulated cosmic rays, high-energy electrons, the chemicals reacted and formed dipeptides, which are paired amino acids, which are definitely essential to life.
So it's possible that this series of events that are, you know, amazing that they all happened within enough time for this to be to work could be the building blocks for life. The only thing we have to do now is wait billions of years to find out if it works.
Oh, well, and you know, the next question after that was, do these dipeptides actually exist in other places? Mm-hmm. Because if they only exist on Earth, then that would be a good indication that this experiment from Hawaii was totally off base. But research out of UC Berkeley and NASA have sampled stuff from Mars and from comets, and both found amino acids. They found dipeptides on Mars, which indicates that this kind of material is indeed floating around the solar system.
Yeah.
And then I guess the next question is whether or not an impact with Earth would help or hamper the situation, because
gotcha.
That much energy is a really big, it's a big bada boom, you know?
Yes.
So a team out of the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology and also out of Nagoya University ran an experiment that simulated the shock of a comet containing amino acids impacting the Earth, and they got tripeptides out of it, which is an even longer amino acid chain and is therefore even more impressive.
Interesting.
So, you know, who knows? Tripeptides are certainly not water bugs or water bears.
Right.
Neither one.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to some of that idea of, if you have organic but non-living material, could that give rise to actual living organisms? And these sort of experiments are really important to add to our understanding about whether or not that's possible. And I love the fact that we have multiple lines of inquiry out there looking at different possibilities. And it may very well be that the real answer is something that we haven't even thought of yet.
Oh, sure. It could absolutely be a combination of any of these systems. And looking into the dual chemical and energetic system that could have brought life here about is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, it really is interesting. So, you know, we've also often said this on the show as well. Sometimes it may seem like a particular experiment or a particular discipline or whatever might seem like a long shot. But the important thing to remember is that we're learning important stuff about ourselves in the process, not just whether or not alien life is out there, but how life had originated and then evolved over time here on Earth. These sort of questions are really awesome. I mean, it's great to learn more about it. And you never know what else you will be able to learn down the line. It can be stuff that ends up changing the course of humanity in the future. So really interesting. I'm glad we got a chance to tackle this. I'm going back and forth about whether or not I need to see Prometheus now. I don't know.
I recommend watching it. It's not good necessarily.
Well, there's a sequel coming out.
I guess I feel the same way. I mean, if you love Alien, it's worth seeing, but it's don't expect it to be good.
Well, you know, Prometheus 2 is Ridley Scott's next feature. That's the next one.
You know,
now that The Martian is done.
I'm fine with that as long as he doesn't go back to doing sword and sandal movies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hear that it's all sword and sandal aliens. It's just one alien riding on the back of a xenomorph.
That sounds great,
yeah,
actually.
That sounds like that.
I'd like
be,
that a lot better than Gladiator. Yeah.
That'd be another movie that we'd have to we'd have to dissect here on the show. So guys, if you have any suggestions for future topics we can tackle here on Forward Thinking, maybe there is a science fiction movie that you want us to look at and discuss the scientific merits or lack thereof, let us know. The email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Twitter, Google+, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google+, we are FW Thinking. Search FW Thinking and Facebook. We'll pop right up. You can leave us a message. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.